The reason that I did this interview for you with Jason Fried, the co-founder of 37 Signals, is that the company he co-founded not only has 1 million people who logged into their websites, registered for accounts, and are using their web-based applications, but many of those people are actually paying for those applications on a monthly basis. Now, how many people do you know who have websites or web applications and can't get anyone to even use those programs, let alone pay for them? What I wanted to find out from Jason is how they did it, how they got the attention, how they got the traffic, how they got the users, and how they got those users to pay. And throughout the interview, you'll be hearing his philosophy and his company's philosophy, because there's a core set of values at play here that helped them build this company, that helped them build those applications and helped them build such a loyal and strong following of customers. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, and I do interviews like the one you're about to listen to because I want you to build a more successful internet business, one that will outlive you and me, one that you could be proud of. Here's my interview with Jason. What is 37 Signals?
We build web-based software for small businesses. We have about 6 products, and they all revolve around collaboration in one way or another. So they're typically used by small businesses to keep in touch and keep track of their clients, projects they're working on, things they're working on internally, calendaring, things like this.
And do you have a metric that you use to show how successful you've been?
Well, revenues are a big part of our business. So we measure our success through our revenues, and also, of course, just making sure our customers are happy with our products. But we watch the numbers every day. I watch them every morning and sometimes a couple times a day just to see how things are going. And ever since we've been doing this, we've been growing, and we've been positive every month for the past 5 years, so things are going pretty well.
You also wrote a book with your philosophy, and you talked about how much the book made. Do you talk about how much individual products make?
We don't share revenues for the individual products. We share revenues occasionally for things like the book and for the job board, which we sell jobs for. We don't sell the jobs, but you can post a job ad on the site for $300 for 30 days, and we share those sorts of revenues, but we don't talk about the products, at least at this point.
Okay, well, since I brought up the book, what's the last number that you shared about the revenue for the book?
I think it was probably roughly about $400,000 in revenues for the book, and it's just about all profits because we self-published the book, although we do sell a paperback now, which we sell through Lulu, and Lulu takes, gosh, I don't remember, maybe 30% per copy or something like this. So we don't get the full revenue or full profit from the paperback, but from the PDF that we sell online, we get the full amount, and that's $19.
Right. And revenue is a core part of your philosophy, that you're not about just creating neat products and seeing what happens. You believe in setting out to make a profit with them, and you have a vision for how that's going to happen, right?
Yeah, so it's not even just about profits, it's also the way we make them. So we don't generate money through advertising. I mean, we generate a little bit of money through advertising, but fundamentally our products make money because we put prices on them and sell them, which is something a lot of people in the tech business aren't really doing. And we think that that's wrong. We think you should be selling your product. That's how things have worked for many, many hundreds of years, and that's what people are comfortable doing. They're comfortable paying for things that they like. So we put prices on things and sell them, and that's how we generate the majority of our revenue. As I mentioned, we do have a little small ad network called The Deck, which we're part of. We make a few $1,000 a month from that, and we do these job ads, which we are making. The economy's kind of taken a hit a bit on them lately, but up until, let's say, a few months ago, we were making roughly $40,000 to $50,000 a month selling these job ads. Lately it's come down. It's also the end of the year, so it's cyclical as well, but so we make some money there as well.
All right, well, you're right that for a long time people resisted what you were saying about making money with the website and charging for things, but today it feels like people have come around to your way of thinking. They realize that advertising's going to go away and it's not as dependable as having solid revenue coming in. So for people who are just now coming around to what you've been saying, what are some ideas that they should keep in mind as they're looking for revenue?
Well, one of the things that we do is we have a monthly recurring subscription model. We found that to be a really successful way of charging for things. And it works really well with web-based software, which is what we do. So this model might not fit for everybody depending on what you're selling, but if you happen to be selling software and you happen to be selling over the web or a service of some sort, a monthly recurring revenue model is really effective. And it's great because, especially in downtimes, I just wrote about this today on our blog, actually. You know, the economy is a little slow right now. People are a little bit more careful. And, you know, for example, if we didn't have any new customers for 3 months, for 6 months, for even a year, not a single new customer, we would still have money coming in from all of our existing customers. And it's very unlikely that all of our existing customers would leave. You know, we have many thousands of customers. So even if we lost 10 or 20% of our existing customer base and didn't pick up any new customers, we'd still have, you know, cash coming in the door, which is, you know, obviously important. And when you're dealing with, you know, one-off sales, when you try and sell something and then you have to sell something else, you have to sell something else, you know, if you don't have any new customers for even a month or two, it could sink you pretty quickly. So in good times, the monthly recurring model is great, and in bad times, it's pretty damn good too. So we're very happy with how that's working.
And one of the reasons that it works is because you have a free version of, I think, every single program that you have, and then there's a paid version. So the free version is still bringing people in, it's still getting people in the door, and the paid version is what the real users are going to upgrade to.
That's true, although the majority of the revenues from our products come from people who sign up for them, or sign up for the paying versions up front. So we definitely have people upgrading from free to pay, but the majority of the people who are on pay started on pay. So we feel like it's definitely a good idea to ask for money up front. You still have a free option if you'd like, but it's been our experience that when you just offer a free option as the only option to sign up and then encourage people to upgrade later, a lot fewer actually do than if you offer maybe a free version and a paid version up front. You're going to have a lot more people picking the paid version than picking the free version upgrading to pay. Of course, more people are going to pick the free version and stay on the free version. That's just natural. But if you're looking to get paying customers, ask for money up front and you'll have a lot better shot of actually getting them.
Jason, a lot of people now have websites and they're just struggling to even get an audience for that website, struggling to get hits over to their websites, people to come even and pay attention to them. Now we're telling them to not only get people to come over to the website, but get those people to take credit cards out of their wallets. How do they make that work?
Well, it takes a while. You know, it depends, of course. You can spend money on advertising to get people, just like a store would. You know, this stuff isn't any different than a store. You know, you have a restaurant down the street, certainly you're going to get some foot traffic, but if you really want to bring in a lot of people, you may have to advertise or you may have to do something else. We found, however, that there's a lot better, or there are better ways to get the word out than spending money to get the word out. What we've kind of been doing for the past few years is teaching a lot about what we do, what works for us, what doesn't work for us, sharing our experiences, building a business, building products, selling those products, marketing those products, getting the word out about those products. We're kind of, you know, opening up our business essentially and telling people how we do what we do. And when you do that, what you end up building is an audience, sort of like you said. A lot of companies have customers, and some companies that are really lucky will have fans, but I've found that the most fortunate companies are the ones that have an audience, because audiences come back every day or every few days to hear what you have to say. Customers might only come back when they want to buy something, and fans definitely are interested too, but when you build an audience, you know, for example, we have 100,000 people a day roughly who read our web blog, Signal versus Noise. So every day 100,000 people are coming to us to hear what we have to say. And that's just, you know, if you can do that, you're in a really, really good position, because it doesn't really cost you anything to, you know, have the ear of 100,000 people. And you don't have to go spend to reach these people. They're coming to you every day. So, you know, this sort of thing takes time, though. And I think a lot of people, especially in the tech world, are missing the point on this. I think that people are a little bit obsessed with immediacy and urgency. And I think people just need to be a little bit more patient and take your time and slowly build an audience. And it will continue to build if you continue to write and share and provide content. And it's just not going to happen overnight or even in 3 or 6 months, but you just got to keep doing it, keep at it, and eventually over time you'll build a nice loyal audience if you're giving people something that they think is valuable. And I think that's how you do it. So I don't have any get rich quick things or overnight success things. It definitely takes time to do this, but we found that sharing is a great way to actually start getting the word out.
And the way you do it is you do it with the conferences that you run yourself, you do it by speaking at other conferences, you do it through your blog, you do it by doing interviews like the one you're doing with me?
Correct.
Are there any other ways that have worked for you?
Well, the book has been a big thing for us. So self-publishing a book, which started out just as a series of blog posts, and then we kind of gathered them up together and polished them up and put them in book form. So that's definitely helped too. But just, you know, using Twitter now is another thing that people can do. You know, typically writing blog posts is, you know, writing is intimidating. It takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of time, and people feel like they have to write something that's really long to be meaningful. And so that's why a lot of people just don't get started, because it seems hard. But, you know, taking advantage of things like Twitter today, where, you know, you have 140 characters to post something and get the word out about something or an idea or whatever, that's a good way to start if you don't want to start writing long things. Just start on Twitter, get your name out there, get people know who you are, share things that are valuable. And then you might, you know, have some ideas that you can't explain in a short burst, and you might want to write something up then, and, you know, and then kind of go from there, and then maybe you might want to package those things up and turn them into a book, or go do some live speaking engagements, or do some video stuff, and just kind of slowly find out what works best for you, what you're comfortable with, and do that. So I wouldn't stand here and tell people to, you know, you got to blog, because that's not what it's all about. It's about what works best for you. We happen to like writing. We write a lot. We're also doing some video stuff. Some people are great on video. Some people are terrible writers, you know, so they should be doing video stuff. Some people are just really good with audio, and they should be doing podcasts, things like that. So find out what works best for you, and just kind of keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it.
And you said that the book helped you get attention. How? Yes. A lot of people will publish a book, and they want to know how they could even promote the book, let alone whatever service that they're building that the book's supposed to promote. So what did you do?
Well, you know, we promoted it to our audience that we've been building. And that's the thing, is that we've been building this audience on our weblog for years before we launched the book. So by the time we had the book done, we had built an audience of, I don't know how many people were reading the blog in 06, but let's say it was 20,000 or something. You know, we had 20,000 people we could reach. And that's the great thing about an audience, is that over time as you build it, you know, you can start selling things to that audience. And they're following you, so they're probably pretty interested in what you have to say. So that's how we started getting the word out. Is we've been building this audience for a while, announced the book to that audience. That audience then have, you know, all those people have their own little audiences, or they're obviously just friends and family and colleagues, and they spread the word for us. Got some media attention here and there. But fundamentally, it's just been word of mouth. And that's just the great thing of having, you know, an audience.
Okay.
But let me just say this, too. I wouldn't expect someone who starting out tomorrow or today to write a book tomorrow. You know, it takes time to get to that level. If you don't have that built-in audience, you're going to have to probably spend some money on press, or you're going to have to work with a more traditional publisher to get the word out about your book. And that's, you know, we're working with a traditional publisher right now on our next book. We're going to experiment with that. And the book probably won't be published for, you know, 12-plus months. It's just a long process. So it all depends on what you want to do. But I would continue to encourage people to try and build their own audience and then self-publish the first book to get that out there the way they want to do it. And then maybe future books they might want to work with a publisher if they want to reach a much broader audience.
I'm even hearing now the publishers are looking for you to come to them, not just with a book, but with an audience of your own that will help sell the book.
Yeah, we found that. When we were looking for publishers, that was kind of a question people had. They were asking us, you know, how are you going to promote the book? Which, you know, I haven't worked with publishers in the past, really, so I don't know if that's a new thing, but I kind of feel like it is. I feel like publishers are looking for authors with their own audience now, just because it's obviously cheaper for them. The sales are going to be better for them because people already have built an audience, which, you know, people might buy the book. But it does seem like that's kind of where things are going, and so I would just encourage people to continue to build one on their own. Also, I think it gives you a lot more leverage. I mean, when we go to a publisher and we say we have 100,000 people reading our blog every day and we have a few million people who use our products, you know, right there they see that they can sell more books that way. So I think you have a lot more leverage in that case.
In preparation for this call, I listened to some of your presentations at past conferences, and a subject that I think you talked about several times is goals, not having goals. And I've been doing interviews about that. Well, first of all, what's your feeling about goals?
Well, my general feeling about goals is that it's okay to think about them and to think about the future and the things you might want to do. I just have a problem with writing them down. And the main reason for that is that when you're writing stuff down, specifically goals and ideas you want to accomplish, you end up being driven by ideas you had a few years ago or thoughts you had a few years ago. And when you wrote the goal down, you were a different person than today. And so you find yourself being driven by things that you thought of when you were someone else. And that's my biggest problem with goals. So what we try and do at the company, 37 Signals, is just kind of think about things we want to do in the next 30, 60, 90 days. Because those are things that we can accomplish, and we're not going to be that different 30, 60, 90 days out. But when you start thinking about, you know, 3-year plans or 5-year plans or 10-year plans, you're just simply guessing. And I think that's actually quite dangerous to think about things a couple years out, just because things are going to be so much different than anyway. Our goals and plans are like putting blinders on. You know, you're saying, I'm going this direction because that's what I said I'm going to do. And things just change too fast for that. So we think about 30, 60, 90 days roughly. We have a few ideas of things we might want to do down the road, but they're not really goals. They're simply just, you know, ideas, things we might want to get done if we have the chance.
What about personally? Do you have a vision for yourself for where you'll be 10 years from now? Do you have a direction and a person you want to be before you die?
No, not really. I don't really think like that either. I guess I want to be alive and happy. It's just about the only thing that I think about long term, really. For much the same reasons, you know, I don't know what opportunities are going to come up. 5 years ago, before we launched Basecamp, you know, we were a web design company. That's what we were doing before we launched our first product. And I had no idea we'd turn into the company we are today, and I had no idea that I'd be doing what I'm doing today. And if I had planned something else, would that, and I'm doing this instead, would that mean that I'm a failure, that I've failed, that I haven't reached my goals, even though I'm doing something that I prefer now? So that's the other danger with goals, is that if you change your mind, does that mean you failed or what? And if you're just going to change your mind, then what's the point of planning in the first place? So that's kind of how I approach things on the more the personal and the business side. It's kind of the same, actually.
How does that square with what we learned in business years ago and what seems to have been true in business since the beginning? Know your goals, know what you're aiming for, even write them down on paper. You're saying the opposite. Is it that we're living in a new world now?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really pay much attention to the way things are supposed to be or the way someone told us to be. So, and I've heard that advice that you should write your goals down. And I'm sure there have been studies that show that if you write them down, you have a better chance of achieving them. My point is that maybe you don't want to achieve that goal that you wrote down. So maybe you can come up with something better along the way. So, yeah, you may achieve the goals, but it's actually, are you selling yourself short by achieving goals you came up with 3 years ago? So that's kind of my feeling about it. I don't really doubt that it might be effective to write them down. I just kind of am skeptical that those are the ones you'll want to follow, especially if they're long-term.
Okay, another concept that keeps coming up in my interviews is the concept of failing fast. Just try something, see if it works. If it doesn't, kill it and try something else. And if it does, you grow the first idea and you make it as big as the market wants. Is that your experience too?
It is. Definitely is. It's just more of what's considered an iterative approach or agile approach is the other word people use these days. Whatever it means, you know, I don't particularly know what the actual definition is, but I think it's the best way to build things, which is, you know, take a couple steps, look around, decide which way you want to go at that point. Take a few more steps, you know, kind of move in these small iterations, these small little steps instead of big, huge steps. This comes back to planning as well. It's very similar. You know, planning out an entire project before you begin or planning out the first feature, the first thing you wanted to do, get that done, then see where you want to go next. And that's kind of our approach is think about things in small, little chunks instead of the big, huge, big picture, which is often too big to think about anyway.
All right. And one of the things that I've heard you say often is embrace constraints.
And right.
And one big constraint for startups is not having enough money. There isn't enough investment being put into startups. You say embrace that. It's not about having money. It's about what then?
Sure. Now, of course, it all depends on what kind of business you're running. So let me just say that up front. I mean, if you're going to be building, you know, car parts, you're probably going to need a die. You're probably going to need, you know, building in a factory and that sort of thing. And you might need capital investment for that. But if you're building a software business or a service or something like that, something that's a little bit more technical or internet-based, you know, you really don't need much. You need a computer, an internet connection. You know, he's talking a couple thousand bucks there, and that's, you know, kind of it. And maybe if you don't have all the skills, you might need to hire some other person, and, you know, so you have one salary, and that's about it. You don't have to deal with rent even. You know, you work out of your house. You don't have to deal with any of these things. And that's good. But the other great thing about not having a lot of money is it forces you to get something out quickly that works. You know, a lot of companies that go out and raise money seem to have these long-term time horizons for getting things out because they have the luxury of stalling. They have the luxury of spending someone else's money, and there's nothing easier than doing that. Spending someone else's money is maybe the easiest thing there is. So I like the fact that, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you're kind of forced to make your own money quickly. And you can't make money if you don't have a product that's out yet. So the idea is that if you're short on cash, you're going to be a little more hungry, and you're going to get your product out quicker because that's what's going to make you money. And I think that's a good thing. And you're going to release something that's not perfect, but that's okay. You know, you'll get better with time, and the product will get better with time. And the only way it's going to get better with time is by actually getting it out there. It's not going to get better with time if you're sitting on it. It's not going to get better with time if you think that you're solving problems people don't have. It's not going to get better with time if you continue to polish and polish and polish it based on your own feedback and not your customer's feedback. So I think it's good to get something out there in the market as soon as you can, and that's one of the great things about not having a lot of money is you kind of have to, you're forced to. And also, another constraint would just be a small team. So we've always believed in small teams. Our products are built with between one and three people, and that forces us into building a simple product. If you have a 10-person team, you build a 10-person product. If you have a 50-person team, you have a 50-person product. Our products are built by one to three people, and we have a one to three person product, which basically means it's pretty simple. It's pretty streamlined. It does just a few things, and that's kind of how we like it.
How do you know how simple to keep it? You've talked a lot about keeping the product simple, making it keeping it focused. How do you know?
Well, we use everything that we build. So we initially build our products for ourselves, and then we assume that there's a lot of other people out there just like us who need similar products. And so if we're pretty happy with it, we think there'll be, you know, certainly enough people out there who agree with us, and they'll be happy with it too. So we keep things simple because that's what we want, and I believe that's what everybody wants. We don't wake up in the morning wishing that things were more complicated today. You know, so if we wake up in the morning and want things simpler, and we're going to be building, or we're going to be using the tools that we built, we're going to keep them simple. And then we just kind of know. We know when they're ready. We know when they're simple enough. We know when they solve the basic problem that we're having. And that's kind of when they're ready to put out there on the market. And then, of course, over time, we can add a few things. And, you know, sometimes it makes things more complex. Sometimes it makes things simpler. But we're always keeping in mind, the basics in mind, that our products should just execute on the basics beautifully is kind of what we like to think. And that's always been the focus of 37 Signals, and I hope it will continue to be. But the real way to do it is to build something that you're going to use and that you want. That's the only way I know of to really build something that really works well. Otherwise, you're just guessing. And even if you have a lot of, you know, market research and you've talked to a lot of customers who use your product, I still feel like you understand it as well as you could if you used it, and that's just such a huge advantage. So when you use it, you typically end up keeping things simple because you don't want to make something that's hard for yourself.
I actually saw an episode of The Simpsons where Homer got to create the ideal car because a car manufacturer said, do you remember that? And
yes.
And he had all these peculiar needs in a car, and he ended up creating a product with a market of one, just him.
Right.
And he couldn't even afford it. So how do you avoid that?
Well, I mean, you have to have a certain amount of discipline, I think, and you have to have just a certain amount of, I don't know if the word is taste or discerning, or whatever it might be. I don't even know really what the word is. The point is that, you know, you have to know when it's enough, you know. You have to know when to stop. You have to know when to say no. And not everyone has that skill, and you can see that in a lot of software products that are built by somebody for their own needs, and they release them, and they're incredibly specific about what they needed. So specific, in fact, that it's difficult for other people to understand what they're doing. Our outlook on things in general is that we try and just, you know, we build things that are specific to our needs, but the things that we build are very generic. So, for example, if we're going to build a to-do list for one of our products, our to-do lists don't have priorities. They don't have color coding. They don't have due dates. They don't have a lot of things that a lot of people might think they need. We've just decided that a to-do list is simply a list with check boxes, and you can check items off when you're done, and that's that. So that's kind of our vision for what we need and for keeping things simple, because it is easy to make a complicated to-do list, but we think that the most effective things are the things that you would write down on paper. So, for example, if you're going to write down a to-do list on paper, you're probably not going to write a priority down. You can't really color code it. You can't do a lot of fancy stuff. You just kind of write stuff down. You go to the grocery store, you make a shopping list, you write things down, you scratch them off when you buy something. And I think that 90% of the time, that's all you really need. And so we're kind of focused on just solving those simple problems and those basic problems, and leaving the really complicated, you know, extra feature stuff to anyone else who wants to tackle it.
What about this? Is it possible that the vast majority of customers, vast majority of users of to-do lists just don't want this? They don't want what you're creating. They do want those features. They want a color code. They understand that, yes, on paper you can't move items up and down and give them priorities, but once you move into the computer, the reason, in fact, to move to the computer is to have those priorities. Is it possible that because you have a core philosophy, you're bringing to you the people who agree with that philosophy, and because it's a heretical philosophy, you're getting more attention and bringing other people towards you who wouldn't have a home otherwise. So maybe this isn't universally true, but you're bringing to you the people who agree with you.
So I think there's two answers there. I actually think it is, well, I was going to say almost universally true, which doesn't really make sense, but I think in general people want simple things. I think that sometimes they think they need more complicated things, but when they actually start using those things, they tend to trend towards the simplest features of those things. It's no different than go buying a home theater thing, you know, with all this stuff, you know, 7.1 sound, and you end up buying two bookshelf speakers because it works. Or, you know, all the complicated things that we all buy every day. We buy more and more and more stuff with more and more features. Like, I just bought a toaster oven. I counted the buttons this morning. It's 15 buttons. I use it to toast bread, and that's it. But, like, it has 15 buttons, and I thought I was going to use all this stuff, and I just throw bread in it, and more waffles, whatever, in the morning, and that's that. So, you know, we think we need all this stuff, but we usually don't. So that's one answer. The other answer is that when you have a point of view and you take a stand, you do attract the kind of people that agree with you. And I think though that's where you have the chance to build a fanatically loyal audience, loyal customer base of people who really share your same points of view. And they're going to go to bat for you. They're going to defend you, because when they defend you, they defend themselves. When they say this is great, they're saying that this is great about them and you. So I think that you have that kind of deep connection with people who really agree with you. And that's why our products take a point of view and have a stand. And our company does the same thing. We don't want to be, you know, Dell. Like, who cares about Dell? Dell just delivers. I don't know what Dell stands for. They just deliver boxes, and, you know, maybe the prices are good or whatever. And they used to kind of stand for something, the direct sales model and whatnot. But, I mean, now they kind of don't really mean anything. You know, or you take a company like Apple, and this is, of course, it's become a very cliche example, but it's a good one, I think. You know, Apple stands for something. They have opinions, and everybody knows it, and some people hate them, and some people love them, but that's kind of the point. That's where you want to be, and that's where we want to be, and that's where we are. We want to stay there. We want some people to hate us. We want some people to love us. It's a lot more interesting than just being stuck somewhere in the middle where no one really cares.
Speaking of the people at your company who many people hate and I know a lot of us love, you intentionally pick well-rounded people to join you at your company. Why? Wouldn't you want someone who focuses really well, who does one thing well, a coder who just codes and doesn't know how to write and doesn't care about design but knows code backwards and forwards?
Yeah, I think that you can find people like that, like great coders who are also interesting people. And so those are the ones that we pick. I think typically well-rounded people are better learners. They're more curious. They can take inspiration from a variety of things. I mean, as a designer, like, I do a lot of the design work here, and I'm inspired. Like, I also like to garden, so I like to be outside and in the soil and planting stuff and looking at plants and whatnot, and I take a lot of inspiration from that in my design, you know, work. And I think if I was just sitting there looking at other graphic designers, I wouldn't be as good. I would just be limited to what graphic designers know about design. There's a lot of other stuff out there that's really interesting. I love architecture. So looking at buildings and structures of buildings and materials and textures and all these things have helped me become, I think, a better graphic designer, better web designer, better interface designer. And I think the same thing would be true for programmers. If someone's just being inspired by other programmers or just code and that's the only thing they're interested in, I think they're missing a much more vibrant, interesting world out there where they can learn a few things about what they do, even if it's not directly related. They just pick up some additional ideas and some inspiration from other things. So we're very interested in having people who have a life outside of their job.
I see, you're right. People who don't have a life outside their jobs and only focus on their own industry have ideas that everyone else in their industry already thought of, and they're just rehashing them. But when you step outside, you're saying you bring in new ideas.
I think so. I mean, it's not to say that there aren't fantastic designers and programmers who are completely self-absorbed in their own work and their own industry. I'm just saying that I think it's more interesting to have people who can see a bigger picture, can see a lot more things outside of their purview, their own small field vision, if they were stuck in their own industry. So I just feel like it's better to have people who have interest in other things. And in fact, at 37 Signals, we encourage people to do other things outside of work. We actually help pay for people's hobbies. So for example, one of our system administrators is taking flying lessons. He wanted to be a pilot. And so we said, we'll pay for half of that. We'll pay for half of your flying lessons. We want to be behind you. We want to support you in this because we think it's interesting and we think you'll be a better person for it. And it's something you really want to do, so we'll give you a hand. And I think that sort of thing is or should be considered by more companies. Instead of maybe just giving somebody a raise or giving somebody a bonus, the company can put that money behind a hobby or behind an interest for that person. I think it says a lot more about the company than simply just handing over $3,000.
How many people are you at the company now?
We have 12 people now.
That's it?
That's it. Yeah, we have 12 people. And we're actually we're widely distributed. So six people are in Chicago. And then we have six people in six other cities around the world. So we have, I hope I get this right. We have somebody in California. We have somebody in Idaho. We have somebody in North Carolina. We have somebody in New York. We have somebody in Toronto. And we have somebody in Spain, Granada, Spain, I believe is where he lives. So we're kind of widely distributed. And we find that to be a pretty big advantage for us, actually, as well. We find that we get more work done when we're not all together. We do get together a couple times a year, and some of the people here in Chicago get together more often than that, but we find that when we are together, we get a lot more work done because we're only together rarely, and so we're really focused on getting stuff done. And then the other times, we can just go off and focus on our own work, and we just found that, you know, the biggest kind of enemy of productivity is interruption. And when everybody's together all the time, it's just so easy to interrupt each other, either by calling a meeting or yelling someone's name across the office or whatever, and you find that you don't get that much work done when you're all together. So since we stay away from each other, we get a lot of work done. And then when we do get the chance to get together, we're really, really effective and really efficient because it's kind of extra fun and extra interesting to get together.
Don't distractions just naturally happen? I mean, I'm here working by myself, and a lot of times it's great not to have the distractions of other people keeping me from my work, but sometimes I find my own distractions. I'll go and make 5 cups of tea in a day. I'll spend too much time reading your blog and all the comments on there. Doesn't that
happen? Yeah, well, I guess it depends what you consider distraction. I hope our site would be very educational. I was totally kidding. The point is that certainly there are distractions everywhere. There's no question about it. And if you want to be distracted, you can be distracted. But we've found, at least with the people that we have here, that people tend to do better work when they're kind of on their own. And I think if you ask most people, they may not admit it, but I think it's hard to ignore the reality that a lot of people do work late at night, early in the morning, because they don't actually get work done during the day. They're unable to. If they have a meeting here, it breaks their day into 45-minute chunks. You know, they get to work, they work for a little bit, then they have to go to a meeting. Then they do something else, and they have lunch. They do something else, and there's a conference call, and they do something else, and there's a meeting, and you don't have that work day anymore. You just have a bunch of little work chunks. And those are the kind of distractions, I think, that can really get in your way. I think you know, reading a site or making some tea or things like that that are more sort of voluntary are often effective. You get up to make some tea when you need a little break. But if you're in the middle of working on something and you have to go to a meeting because someone called one and you just have to do it, that's not voluntary anymore. So you might be in a zone and now you have to stop because of someone else's schedule. But if you are doing something and you just feel like getting up and, you know, even watching TV or whatever, that's something you do on your own schedule. You may have worked 3 hours straight before that, and then you take a little break, and that's totally fine. So I think it's the type of breaks and the types of schedules that you have to break for that make the difference.
Why do you think that people need to know how to write well today? Why is that important?
Well, most communication these days, at least in our business, is written. So, you know, people send emails back and forth, or they post messages to Basecamp, or they send IMs back and forth, or whatever it might be. A lot of the stuff's written these days, and so I think it's important to be able to communicate through writing. I also think that it makes you just a clearer thinker in general to have to think through how you're going to say something. Writing is, you know, usually don't write in real time in front of people. You write something, you think about it. You might edit it or whatever, and then you might send it off. I just think it helps you collect your thoughts, and I think that's a real benefit. We definitely use the phone, we use voice, you know, here and there, but most of our communication is written, which is why I think it's especially important. Plus, the fact that we talk about how we teach a lot, you know, blogging is, even though we do video and whatnot, blogging is still the main way that we get the word out. And so it's great that everyone at 37 Signals feels comfortable enough in their writing skills to actually share and write, you know, in public. And that's just kind of a nice side effect of having good writers.
It keeps coming back to teach, 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 right? That's a big part of what you do. Teach within the company, but more importantly, have your people constantly teach outside the company.
Yes.
And it's
definitely.
Why? Where'd you come up with this?
I don't know. It seems natural. But one of the groups of people I sort of lean on for this are chefs, are famous chefs who have cookbooks. I think that the cookbook model is a great model, in that a lot of the chefs that people know by name aren't necessarily the best chefs, although I'm sure they're very good. But people like, you know, Mario Batali and Emeril Lagasse and you know, Julia Child from way back, and you know, these sorts of people. They put out cookbooks, they have cooking shows, they're out there teaching people how to do what they do. They're saying, hey, I'm a chef, I know what I'm doing, let me show you how easy it is. It's not even that hard, just watch me and I'll show you. And not even only show you, I'm going to put out a cookbook with all my, you know, quote, secrets in it. These are my recipes, exact measurements of what I do. And, you know, that helps them. It helps their businesses, it helps their brand, it helps their own restaurants. And you would think that it wouldn't help them. You would think that, you know, if Mario Batali puts out an Italian cookbook and tells you how to cook his food, that someone's going to take these ideas and open a restaurant right next to his and put him out of business. But that's, of course, just not how it works. Instead, a lot more people are inspired and trust him and look to him for guidance and leadership. And that just, in the end, helps his brand. It makes him more of an authority on things. It makes him a trusted figure. And when you're going to go to a new city and you hear there's a Mario Batali restaurant right there, you know, and you've been reading his cookbooks and trying some recipes and watching a show, you're going to go to his restaurant too. And I just think that chefs, cookbooks, cooking shows, that whole genre is a really great way, is a good sort of approach to emulate in terms of getting the word out and building credibility amongst an audience.
All right, one final question, Jason. If sure. you weren't at 37 Signals, what would you be doing?
I think I would probably want to be an architect. Or a chef, although I'm not really a great cook, but I love the idea of creating stuff. And you know, being a chef is all about creating stuff, and being an architect is as well. I just find architecture fascinating, and I think that I maybe would have gone to school for architecture had I not gone to school for finances, which is what my degree's in. But I think if I wasn't doing this, I would study architecture.
Well, is there anything that I missed in this interview? Anything that you think people need to learn?
No, the only thing I would say is I think whatever it is that you're doing, you should just err on the side of simple. I feel like every mistake we've made as a company has been because we tried to do too much instead of not trying to do enough. Whenever we make mistakes, it's because we bite off more than we can chew, we take on a project that's too big or too long, We have too many people involved in something, and I would just recommend that everybody just kind of err on the side of simple as often as possible with whatever it is they're doing, and they'll find that that's often, not only is it adequate, but it's actually the better solution, especially initially and early on, whatever that is that they're doing. So hope people can take that advice and give it a try.
That's great. Well, thank you, Jason. Thanks for doing this interview with me. I appreciate it.
Hey, you bet. Thanks for having me. It was good to talk with you.
All right, and there's the interview. Well, thank you for listening. As a follow-up to this, I hope you come back to Mixergy.com and let me know what you thought of this interview. Also, go back to Mixergy.com and check out some of the other interviews that I do. I do interviews with people who are going to teach you how to build internet companies, experts who are doing it for themselves, who are willing to spend some time on the phone with me, teaching you and me how they did it and what you and I could learn from their experiences. Lots of other interviews on Mixergy.com. I hope you come back and listen to them, and I hope you come back and give me your feedback on this interview. Thank you again for listening to this interview, and I'll see you on Mixergy.com.